readers, welcome back to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I am so happy to be sharing this time with you today. I hope you're having an amazing holiday season with lots more merriment to come. Now that the holiday shopping crush is over, unless, like me, you might plan to hit an after Christmas sale or two. But wait, I digress. Ahem. Now that the Christmas shopping rush is over, I find myself thinking back over the year, and quite a year it was. So, with this mood for looking back on my mind, and I bet yours too, I think a focus on history and biography titles might be just the ticket for our show this week. We'll get started right after this.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Cleopatra. Say the name and a multitude of images jump to mind. Beautiful, exotic, intriguing, powerful. Cleopatra's palace shimmered with onyx, garnets, and gold, but it was richer still in political and sexual intrigue. There's been so much buzz about Stacy Schiff's new book, Cleopatra, A Life, I thought we should take a trip down the Nile and around the Mediterranean to explore it. Though Cleopatra's life spanned fewer than 40 years, it reshaped the contours of the ancient world. When I read the book, I was stunned by how little I had previously known about her actual life. For example, did you realize Cleopatra was not Egyptian? That she had one child with Julius Caesar and three more with Mark Antony? As you read this history, you'll certainly come to admire Cleopatra's talents as a shrewd strategist and ingenious negotiator. As I listened to this book, though, I really did learn quite a bit. But I must say, it was not the most engaging history I've read of late. It could have used a dose of warmth and a little more even-handedness in the treatment. It seems that, to the author, Cleo could do no wrong, but you be the judge. Here's Cleopatra, A Life, read by Robin Miles.
Like all lives that lend themselves to poetry, Cleopatra's was one of dislocations and disappointments. She grew up amid unsurpassed luxury to inherit a kingdom in decline. For 10 generations, her family had styled themselves pharaohs. The Ptolemies were, in fact, Macedonian Greek, which makes Cleopatra approximately as Egyptian as Elizabeth Taylor. At 18, Cleopatra and her 10-year-old brother assumed control of a country with a weighty past and a wobbly future. 1,300 years separate Cleopatra from Nefertiti. The pyramids, to which Cleopatra almost certainly introduced Julius Caesar, already sported graffiti. The Sphinx had undergone a major restoration 1,000 years earlier. And the glory of the once great Ptolemaic Empire had dimmed. Cleopatra came of age in a world shadowed by Rome, which in the course of her childhood extended its rule to Egypt's borders. When Cleopatra was 11, Caesar reminded his officers that if they did not make war, if they did not obtain riches and rule others, they were not Romans. An Eastern sovereign who waged an epic battle of his own against Rome articulated what would become Cleopatra's predicament differently. The Romans had the temperament of wolves. They hated great kings. Everything they possessed, they had plundered. They intended to seize all and would either destroy everything or perish in the attempt. The implications for the last remaining wealthy country in Rome's sphere of influence were clear. Egypt had distinguished itself for its nimble negotiating. For the most part, it retained its autonomy. It had also already embroiled itself in Roman affairs. For a staggering sum of money, Cleopatra's father had secured the official designation friend and ally of the Roman people. His daughter would discover that it was not sufficient to be a friend to that people and their Senate. It was essential to befriend the most powerful Roman of the day. That made for a bewildering assignment in the late Republic, racked by civil wars. They flared up regularly throughout Cleopatra's lifetime, pitting a succession of Roman commanders against one another in what was essentially a hot-tempered contest of personal ambition, twice unexpectedly decided on Egyptian soil. Each convulsion left the Mediterranean world shuddering, scrambling to correct its loyalties and redirect its tributes. Cleopatra's father had thrown in his lot with Pompey the Great, the brilliant Roman general on whom good fortune seemed eternally to shine. He became the family patron. He also entered into a civil war against Julius Caesar, just as, across the Mediterranean, Cleopatra ascended to the throne. In the summer of 48 BC, Caesar dealt Pompey a crushing defeat in central Greece. Pompey fled to Egypt to be stabbed and decapitated on an Egyptian beach. Cleopatra was 21. She had no choice but to ingratiate herself with the new master of the Roman world. She did so differently from most other client kings, whose names, not incidentally, are forgotten today. For the next years, she struggled to turn the implacable Roman tide to her advantage, changing patrons again after Caesar's murder, ultimately to wind up with his protege Mark Antony. From a distance, her reign amounts to a reprieve. Her story was essentially over before it began, although that is, of course, not the way she would have seen it. With her death, Egypt became a Roman province. It would not recover its autonomy until the 20th century. Can anything good be said of a woman who slept with the two most powerful men of her time? Possibly, but not in an age when Rome controlled the narrative. Cleopatra stood at one of the most dangerous intersections in history, that of women and power. Clever women, Euripides had warned hundreds of years earlier, were dangerous.
Susan Cheever does not write the same book twice. Her work has spanned topics as diverse as alcoholism, parenting, sexual addiction, and a memoir about her father, John Cheever. Most recently, she's been writing about the landscape of intersecting personal lives of the cluster of literary geniuses who lived in Concord, Massachusetts in the mid-1800s, Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry David Thoreau. Now, Susan draws on Louisa May Alcott for an in-depth look at the author of one of America's most beloved children's books, Little Women. Cheever portrays Alcott as a woman with problems and aspirations that resonate strongly a century and a half later, and big questions of identity, happiness, work, family, and love. The literary group in Concord transformed not only American literature and culture, they transformed each other, seducing one another both intellectually and physically. In fact, Alcott was in love with both older man Thoreau and then much older man Emerson. Susan has also written for many publications, including The New Yorker and The New York Times. She's taught at Yale and is on the faculty of the Bennington College MFA program. Susan was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award and won a Guggenheim Fellowship. Welcome, Susan. It's so great to have you with us today.
It's nice to be here.
I'm going to jump right into the first question, which is, recently you've written about the amazing group of people in Concord, Massachusetts, who included Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Henry David Thoreau, just to name a few. Now I'm wondering why you chose to write first a single look at Louisa May Alcott herself.
Well, when I was writing about Concord, Massachusetts in the 19th century and the amazing group of professional writers who lived there and who knew each other and helped each other as people and as writers, really our first group of professional writers in this country and the writers of the first memoir in this country, which was Walden, and, you know, writers who really broke ground and really set the foundation for all of American literature, I just became more and more fascinated by Louisa May Alcott. For one thing, she isn't generally thought of as a member of the Transcendentalist movement, even though she was right there. Usually the Transcendentalists are studied as a movement, but usually only the men are studied. And they've been studied very, very brilliantly by Van Wyck Brooks, by F.O. Matheson, by all kinds of people, but the women generally get left out of those studies. So I was very interested in the women, in Louisa May Alcott particularly, because it seemed to me that in her life and in her work, she embodied these questions that most women have to wrestle with in their lives, these questions of love and money and how you're going to balance those two things, and the question of how are you going to use your sexual currency as a young girl, and how are you going to try to use your intellectual currency as you grow older, and, you know, are you going to marry the Laurie character, for instance, who's very wealthy, but you don't really love him? Or are you going to look for something else? Or are you going to marry an older professor? Or are you going to, as Louisa chose, marry no one? She said, liberty is a better husband than any one man. So these are questions that were very alive in the 1850s and 60s and are still alive and unanswered, it seems to me, for my daughter, for the women in her generation, and even for older women. So I just thought, this is something I want to write about. This is something I want to look at. And Louisa May Alcott, there are really three parts of her life: the writing part, the money part, and the love part. And the way in which she juggled those three things and wrote about them, I just found endlessly fascinating. And of course, she's such a brilliant writer. That was another thing. I felt that Louisa May Alcott, of all those writers, was the one who had not really been discovered and given her due. You know, nobody understands that she was a huge influence on Henry James, who was a friend of hers who reviewed her first novel. Very few people understand that she read everything and that Emerson respected her and that she did work. She wrote one of the only books about nursing during the Civil War. She was a Civil War nurse. It's really the only book written by a female nurse out of the Civil War around the time of Fredericksburg. And I felt that, you know, she's very unrecognized. She's not taught in college. Little Women is a brilliant novel, which is how I started. Someone had asked me to write an introduction to Little Women, so I reread it, and it just knocked my socks off. It's just an amazingly good novel, which, you know, when I read it when I was 12 and 13 and 14 and 15 over and over and over again, I didn't know what a good novel was in those days. But now I do. And when I reread it in 1999, I thought, oh my God, this is just a brilliant novel. And I wondered why the novel... why I didn't study it in college. I was an American studies major. Louisa May Alcott was definitely not on the syllabus.
Speaking about Civil War times, I mean, the family was known as such strong abolitionists. Do you get into that quite a bit in the book?
I certainly get into Bronson Alcott's very admirable, into his educational ideas and into the way they became a stop on the Underground Railroad. But of course, the real contribution to anti-slavery came from Louisa, who actually went down to Washington and served as a nurse, something her father did not do. So again, Bronson Alcott gets all this credit for being one of the first anti-slavery speakers, and he was very, very strong about this, but it was Louisa who actually put her life on the line.
Yes. How do you think your readers will compare the idealized, you know, portrayal of Louisa May Alcott to the very real woman you write about in your book?
You mean the idealized portrayal of Louisa May Alcott in Little Women?
Yes.
Well, I think most people know the difference between fiction and fact. And I think that in writing Little Women, which, of course, she didn't want to write, Louisa May Alcott wrote about the family she desperately wished she had. I mean, she invented a servant to do the jobs that had been her jobs. you know? So that's the kind of yearning and longing that you see in Little Women. And I think that's one of the things that makes the book so powerful, is that it's really suffused with her longing for a family which she didn't have. I mean, many of the details are the same, of course, but there was no loving Hannah to do the grunt work. Louisa had to do it. Her father was very much in attendance all the time, making nothing but trouble for Louisa. In Little Women, he's left out. And Louisa, who was the rebel of the family and the dark-haired girl and the troublesome girl, was constantly being scolded and punished from a very young age for being who she was.
Do you think that people should read Little Women and then read your book as kind of a companion series, if you will?
Well, I think everybody should read Little Women. And I certainly think if you're interested in reading Little Women, you would want to read a biography of Louisa May Alcott. And I was able to do things in my biography, just because it's 2010, that other people haven't done before. In other words, I was able to encompass other biographies and talk about other biographies as well as just talking about the life. So people ask about the subtitle, A Personal Biography. What that means is it's not just a recitation of fact, although I did a ton of research and there are plenty of facts in there, but I also wrote it for readers. I also wrote it for readers. And when there are places where other biographies disagree and the documentation has been destroyed, and Louisa destroyed a lot of documentation, I say so in the book. So it really takes in more than the previous biographies, although many of the previous biographies are wonderful.
Do you think so many writers today work in writers' groups and critique their work and share and look for criticism? Do you think that was really happening back then? And to what extent did Louisa have impact on other writings at that time?
Well, I don't know about your original statement that so many writers today work in groups.
Well, we've been hearing from some people that they maybe don't... I guess starting out writers tend to, you know, share their work in writing groups. So I'm wondering if there was any kind of work sharing then.
Well, I think that the idea, in my experience, writing groups are deeply problematic. Deeply, deeply problematic. And I teach, of course, writing and using the workshop model, but that's a very different situation. In other words, you have teachers who are actually guiding the process. And I think that's what makes that work. But I think that most writers have a few other people whose judgment they trust. In my experience, this is not, they don't all meet together. But for instance, I have a few other people whose judgment I trust, and I will read my work to them over the phone, or I will send them a page or two, or I will send them a chapter even, and they will respond to it, and I listen to them, because these are the two or three, I can only think of three right now, people that I trust and whose judgment is interesting to me. I also find, in spite of what you'll hear, that my editor at whatever publishing house I'm at often has very detailed things to say and very pronounced ideas about what should and shouldn't happen, and I listen to those as well. As I've gotten more experienced as a writer, I'm willing to try anything. I feel as if I'm not going to lose by trying something else. I can always go back to the original. So I'm very open to that kind of criticism. I was not as a young writer. I was very frightened by the idea that I would somehow lose my voice or that something bad would happen if I listened to other people. But we don't meet as a group. Mm-hmm. In other words, there are 3, 4, 5, if you count the publishing house, my agent, people whose judgment I really respect, and I certainly go to them. And Louisa did exactly the same thing. She went to her father, she went to Emerson, she went to her mother, she went to Thoreau. In other words, she also had a group of people, an extraordinary group of people, to whom she could read her work. But my group is also extraordinary, but they don't include Ralph Waldo Emerson, Bronson Alcott, and Henry David Thoreau, but they're pretty amazing.
Now, what project are you working on now?
I'm working on a biography of E.E. Cummings, the poet.
And will you be using mostly lowercase in that biography?
No, I won't. No.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us today. It is a really fascinating book, and I encourage all of our listeners to pick it up. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Elaine.
All of us read and loved Little Women in our school days. But as adults, if you reread the book, you'll discover important and timely themes. Fresh from her success with American Bloomsbury, which looked at the writers and artists revolving around Concord, Mass. In the mid-19th century, Susan Cheever now turns her full attention to a bright star of that group, Louisa May Alcott. Based on extensive research and access to Alcott's journals and correspondence, Cheever chronicles Alcott's life, beginning with the fateful meeting of her parents, to Louisa's own death just 2 days after that of her dynamic and domineering father, Bronson. Cheever examines Alcott's role as a woman and a working member of an extremely dynamic group that included Ralph Waldo Emerson, John and Henry Thoreau, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry James, and Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, Edgar Allan Poe, and others, the men and women that were at the heart of American idealism. Let's listen as Tavia Gilbert narrates.
As a naughty, rebellious girl in the throes of puberty, I needed help, and it seemed to come from the pages of Little Women. What did it mean to be a woman, anyway? Should I do as my parents suggested and aim at being pretty and popular and having my pick of desirable men? Should I become a woman whose identity was a wife and mother as my mother had? Should I be some man's little woman? Or should I strike out like Joe March and have great adventures and live alone in a house I paid for and risk being lonely? With the character of Joe March, Louisa May Alcott gave words to the dialogue between woman as sexual domestic creature and woman as successful professional. How can a woman avoid the trap of dependence and still have family satisfactions? How can she enjoy the rich satisfactions of good work and earning money without missing out on a domestic life? Little Women seemed like a guide through this morass of feminine questions, many of which I could not articulate in those days. Last summer, decades after my first trip to Orchard House, after a life that has only imperfectly answered the questions I had as a girl, I sat and watched as crowds of young girls walked up the path to the pretty brown house where Alcott wrote her masterpiece. Now lovingly restored and under the directorship of Jan Turnquist, a woman so in tune with Louisa May Alcott that she will frequently dress in the clothes Louisa would have worn and act out her heroine, Orchard House is backed by a stand of trees and sits near the Lexington Road about a mile away from the center of Concord. Walden Pond, where the Alcott's friend and teacher, Henry David Thoreau, built his famous hut, is another mile on through the trees. The White House where their friend Ralph Waldo Emerson lived with his family and ran a brilliant rotating literary salon is down the road in the other direction. The thousands of women who visit Orchard House each year seem to be looking for guidance. Many of them have read Little Women. Some of them have only seen one of the three excellent movies made of the book that star, in chronological order, Katharine Hepburn, June Allison, and Winona Ryder. But they are there for the same reasons. The house gets 35,000 visitors a year. They patiently listen as local guides begin in the Alcott's dark kitchen, with its soapstone sink and wood stove, where Abba Alcott and her daughters did the cooking and washing with water from the well. They troop into the small dining room with a cupboard filled with Abba's green and white May family china. Fiction and fact are overlaid in this small room, where the Alcotts ate their vegetarian meals, and the fictional Marches also ate meals. The March meals were spare, but conventional. There was no meat because they were poor. The Alcott meals often consisted of graham meal and apples. Meat was not just expensive. It was one of Bronson Alcott's many personal devils. Although Louisa May Alcott set her story in Orchard House, and the rooms coincide with the scenes with Little Women, The actual events of her teenage years occurred in a different house, a yellow clapboard place called The Wayside, 100 yards down the road, where the Alcott family lived when the sisters were growing up. That house, in which the young Louisa experienced her actual adolescence, is more rarely visited than Orchard House. It is run by the National Park Service and is closed 3 days a week. By the time the Alcotts moved into Orchard House in 1858, Louisa was 26, her beloved sister Lizzie was dead, and her older sister Anna was engaged to John Pratt. The merging of real and fictional during the Orchard House tour heightens the sense that it is a kind of spiritual journey. Visitors aren't there to see the real place where the Alcott sisters came of age. If they were, they would walk down the street to the wayside. They are there to visit the fictional sisters, who lived and thrived and laughed and cried in Louisa May Alcott's imagined Orchard House. They chuckle when the guide points out Joe's mood pillow, a horsehair rectangle which was horizontal when the fictional Joe felt like talking, and vertical when she was best left alone. The tour guide usually explains that the March family hung a curtain between the parlor and the living room for Joe's theatrical productions. The audience sat in the front parlor. The actors and actresses, the March sisters, could use the back stairs for costume changes. The Alcott sisters never used the Orchard House parlor for their theatrical performances. The March sisters did.
Readers, I couldn't resist this one. This story is so captivating. It's not just for the girls. It's time to take five. Chanel number five. The Secret of Chanel No. 5, The Intimate History of the World's Most Famous Perfume by Tilar Mazzeo, is the story of one of the world's most famous brands. Every minute, someone buys an Art Deco-inspired amber-hued bottle of Chanel No. 5, to the tune of more than 500,000 bottles a year. Considering that nearly 90 years have passed since the No. 5's creation, this statistic alone makes a compelling case for the perfume's stature as the world's most famous. However, its cultural impact might be even more staggering than its business success. Andy Warhol's silkscreen version of the bottle helped to make its image iconic. Mitch Ryder's Devil in a Blue Dress famously wore it. And when Marilyn Monroe was asked what she wore to bed, she replied, with more than a hint of flirtation, "Why? Chanel No. 5, of course." We all may know the story of Coco Chanel, but not the tale of one of her most enduring creations, her signature perfume, a fragrance that has enjoyed a remarkable success for nearly a century. The Secret of Chanel No. 5 is a far-ranging and often quixotic search to discover the answer. Let's take a delightful whiff. Liz Desnera narrates.
That pivotal moment after the First Great War, when the world was determined to leave behind a painful past and to embrace all the promises of the new and the modern. Suddenly, once unimaginable things seemed possible. Albert Einstein won the Nobel Prize for reimagining the laws of physics, and once deadly diseases were tamed by the miracle of vaccinations. At the beginning of that decade, America had just a handful of millionaires. A few years later, the ranks of the super rich had swelled by more than 700% to a number approaching 15,000, ushering in what promised to be a new Gilded Age. The bustling post-war economies created a new standard of wealth and luxury, and for the first time, it all seemed within reach of the average person. There were wireless radios and talkie films, cars for the middle classes, and chic ready-made fashions, and fine French perfumes, on the floors of glittering department stores, another phenomenon of this enticing new commercial era. This was the decade of New York and Paris, and of all the things that happened at a moment when the distance between those two great cities was beginning to seem just a little bit shorter. It was the decade of superstars and heroes. And as the rise of rapid communication created the beginnings of an international cosmopolitan culture, it also became the era of celebrity icons. Babe Ruth led the New York Yankees to 3 World Series titles in that roaring decade. And Charles Lindbergh flew 33 hours from New York to Paris. Clara Bow became the world's first It Girl. Charlie Chaplin took Hollywood slapstick to dizzying heights. And on the nighttime stages in France's capital, the sultry Josephine Baker danced topless to breathless applause, night after night, during the interwar years. Among all the icons of the 1920s, however, none could touch Coco Chanel, already acknowledged as one of the most chic and influential women of an entire generation. The line between legend and history, however, is wonderfully and perplexingly malleable. Much of what is told and retold as conventional wisdom about the spectacular rise of Chanel No. 5 and its transformation into an international byword for luxury is the stuff of half-truths, confusion, collective fantasy, and sheer invention. Sometimes the truth that those legends obscure is more fantastic than any fiction. Consider all the things you think you know about Chanel No. 5, which, for most of its history, has been the best-selling fragrance of all time and among the 20th century's most coveted luxury objects. Perhaps you remember how this unique scent was invented in the summer of 1920 by the young fashion designer Gabrielle Coco Chanel. Except it wasn't. In fact, it was already a scent with a long and tangled history, a history about nothing so much as the intimacy of loss and desire. Perhaps you've read sources that tell how Chanel No. 5 stunned the world of traditional fragrance as a dazzling new technical innovation, history's first synthetic composition, its first abstract scent, its novel use of the perfume materials known as aldehydes. Indeed, it's likely that you have, because this claim is a key part of the legend of how Chanel No. 5 became a phenomenon. The trouble is that none of this is true, either. Chanel No. 5 wasn't the first perfume to do any of those things. It wasn't even the second. Poised on the brink of what is still known as the golden age of perfumery, Chanel No. 5 was a genuine revolution that changed the history of fragrance forever, and one of the great works of a new kind of art in a dazzling modern era. What makes it spectacular, however, is something different, something that makes it enduringly and genuinely sexy. Among the widely held beliefs, there is one that is nearly universal, the idea that clever and persistent advertising created Chanel No. 5's international fame. Despite the beauty of a scent that perfume experts applaud as a milestone and masterpiece, who could doubt that its celebrity and staying power comes down to brilliant marketing?
Described by the Chicago Tribune as a classic, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt by Edmund Morris stands as one of the greatest biographies of our times. Readers, I became enthralled with TR when I worked at the Library of Congress. Walking through the halls one day, I came across an exhibit of Teddy's letters to his children. They were so animated, so detailed, and so entertaining, I became an instant Teddyophile. The book, which covers TR from his birth to his assumption of the presidency, is a sweeping narrative of the man and a shrewd examination of his character. It is one of those rare works that is both definitive for the period it covers and fascinating to read for sheer entertainment. Theodore Roosevelt comes to life largely through his words and those of people who knew him. Morris unearths and culls an ocean of original data and molds it into a page-turning narrative. T.R. was a voluminous reader, a polished author of popular books, a gripping orator, and a politician who was able to juggle a tricky political climate while maintaining his personal integrity. You get a sense that whatever he chose to do, he did with his whole soul and with his trademark joyful combativeness. This is an enriching, animated portrait befitting one of our most dynamic, driven, and perhaps manic presidents. You're sure to enjoy it, and the narration by Mark Deakins.
Inspired by the balmy weather, many of the president's guests arrive on foot. Lafayette Square is crowded with elegant young men and women. Naval officers march five abreast, their plumes frothing in unison. Chinese grandees drag heavy silk robes. Grizzled veterans of the Civil War stomp along with tinkling medals, and the crowd parts respectfully before them. The air is full of high-spirited conversation and laughter, while the music pouring out of the White House, a continuous medley now of jigs and Joplin rags, creates an irresistible holiday mood. A newspaperman is struck by the happiness he sees everywhere on this, the best and fairest day President Roosevelt ever had. Such superlatives in praise of the weather are mild in comparison with those being lavished on the State of the Union. On this day of our Lord, January 1, 1907, the Washington Evening Star reports, we are the richest people in the world. The national wealth has been rolling up at the rate of $4.6 billion per year, $127.3 million per day, $5.5 million per hour, $88,430 per minute, and $1,474 per second during President Roosevelt's two administrations. Never have American farmers harvested such tremendous crops. Railroads are groaning under the weight of unprecedented payloads. Shipyards throb with record construction. The banks are awash with the spring tide of money. Every one of the 45 states has enriched itself since the last census, and in per capita terms, Washington, D.C. is now the richest spot on earth. Politically, too, it has been a year of superlatives, many of them supplied with characteristic immodesty by the president himself. No Congress in our time has done more good work, he fondly told the 59th, having battered it into submission with the sheer volume of his social legislation. He calls its first session the most substantial in his experience of public affairs. Joseph G. Cannon, the Speaker of the House, agrees, with one reservation, about the president's methods. Roosevelt's all right, says Cannon, but he's got no more use for the Constitution than a tomcat has for a marriage license. Theodore the Sudden has been accused of having a similar contempt for international law ever since the afternoon in 1903 when he allowed a U.S. warship to monitor the Panamanian Revolution. If he loses any sleep over his role in that questionable coup d'etat, he shows no sign. On the contrary, he glories in the fact that America is now actually building the Panama Canal after four centuries of conversation by other nations. A few weeks ago, he visited the Canal Zone, the first trip abroad by a U.S. president in office, and the colossal excavations there moved him to Shakespearean hyperbole. It shall be in future enough to say of any man, he was connected with the digging of the Panama Canal to confer the patent of nobility on that man, Roosevelt told his sweating engineers. From time to time, little men will come along to find fault with what you have done. They will go down the stream like bubbles. They will vanish. But the work you have done will remain for the ages. Few indeed are the little men who can find fault with the president on this beautiful New Year's Day, but they are correspondingly shrill. Congressman James Wadsworth, a battered opponent of Roosevelt's Pure Food Act, which goes into effect today, growls that the bloody hero of Kettle Hill is unreliable, a faker, and a humbug. The editor of the St. Louis Censor, who has never forgiven Roosevelt for inviting a black man to dine in the White House, warns that he is now trying to end segregation of Orientals in San Francisco schools. Almost every week, his administration has been characterized by some outrageous act of usurpation. He is the most dangerous foe to human liberty that has ever set foot on American soil. Another Southerner, by the name of Woodrow Wilson, is tempted to agree. He is the most dangerous man of the age. Mark Twain believes that the president is clearly insane and insanest upon war and its supreme glories. Roosevelt is used to such criticism. He's been hearing it all his life. If a man has a very decided character, has a strongly accentuated career, it is normally the case, of course, that he makes ardent friends and bitter enemies. Yet even impartial observers will admit there is a grain of truth in Twain's assertions.
Peters, my executive producer, Derek Hewitt, was fortunate to run into Sebastian Junger at this year's Miami International Book Fair. As I'm sure you know, Junger is the internationally acclaimed author of, among other titles, The Perfect Storm, a New York Times bestseller for more than 3 years, and a major motion picture starring George Clooney. As a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and as a contributor to ABC News, Junger has covered major international news stories in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Kosovo, Bosnia, Kashmir, and other hotspots around the globe. For over a year, Junger and photojournalist Tim Heatherton were embedded in a battle company of the 173rd Airborne Brigade Combat Team in a remote and heavily contested eastern Afghanistan valley. Reporting on the war from the soldiers' perspective, Junger spent weeks at a time at an outpost that saw more combat than almost anywhere else in the entire country. The professional result is twofold: the book titled War, and a 96-minute documentary, Restrepo, that won the 2010 Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. Perhaps you've seen it. Junger is a native New Englander and a graduate of Wesleyan University, attracted since childhood to extreme situations and people at the edges of things. Junger worked as a high climber for tree removal companies. After a chainsaw injury, he decided to focus on journalism, primarily writing about people with dangerous jobs, from firefighting to commercial fishing. A fascinating man. Let's listen to his chat with Derek.
Welcome, Sebastian.
Thank you.
You are in a very unusual and exciting genre, which has been described as adventure nonfiction. What does that really mean for our listeners?
I mean, it's a curious word because definitely the soldiers aren't having an adventure the way most civilians understand it. Likewise, the crew of the Andrea Gale, the sword fishing boat that was lost in my book, The Perfect Storm, you know, they were making a living. They weren't having an adventure. But I do understand what that means. It means a kind of journalism that's focused on situations that are sort of outside of societal control. You're on a fishing boat in a storm, you're on the top of Mount Everest, you're in combat. The irony is that a lot of those people don't understand they're having an adventure. They think they're making a living. But what I try to do as a journalist, I mean, those situations are inherently dramatic, and I try to go into them and not just focus on the drama, on the excitement or whatever, but really try to bring out something fundamental about human nature, about people and how they interact and how they survive and function in small groups. That really is sort of the thing that interests me about that genre.
It seems to me that you're writing in the tradition of maybe a Hemingway or even a Stanley, going in deep into situations so that what you bring back is really from the front lines reporting. Are you guys always looking for trouble?
Well, trouble's interesting, isn't it? You know, I mean, trouble's always always compelling, and so it's an easy thing to, in some ways it's an easy thing to write about. I mean, Hemingway, I mean, he was sort of a news reporter, and then he became a novelist and wrote fiction about those situations. You know, I've never written fiction, so we do sort of part paths in that sense. But more to your point, I think there is something fundamentally fascinating about these kind of dangerous, bold, very black and white situations where the stakes are very high. I mean, life and death. And I think that the same Hemingway was probably responding to that in the same way that I am, and you know, in my generation, in situations I'm in.
It seems to me that you're taking advantage of every medium available to give the fullest possible picture of the situation. For example, you just spent 15 months embedded with the U.S. Army, and the product is a great movie, Restrepo, as well as a related book, War. It occurs to me, how the heck did you manage to write a book in those conditions when you were embedded with the Army?
You know, I actually wrote it back home. You know, I took my notes out there. I never compose my work in the field, but I take very extensive notes, and I've always done that. And what I found is that the situations that were good for filming, you know, combat or fast-moving conversations, are exactly the situations that are ill-suited to taking notes. And then there's moments that are very quiet and thoughtful that are boring as hell on film. They're perfect for absorbing as a writer with a notebook and a pen and really sort of thinking through things and trying to absorb the subtler realities out there. So for me, it was quite easy to do both. I mean, I had a video camera around my shoulder, clipped to my bulletproof vest with a carabiner all the time. I mean, literally, if I was awake, the camera was on my shoulder, and I filmed all day long. And then at night, I would write my notes. I kept the kind of journal. And then when I came home, I edited the movie with my partner, Tim Hetherington, and I wrote my book.
Sounds amazing. This last week, there's been some really interesting news about the award of Medal of Honor to Staff Sergeant Saul Giunta, who was the first, one of the only living recipients of the Medal of Honor. Tell us how that came about.
Sal was in 1st Platoon. I was with 2nd Platoon. A platoon's about 30 men. Sal was with 1st Platoon, so I met him out there. I didn't know him particularly well, but he was in the same deployment, same valley, same unit that I accompanied. 1st Platoon was ambushed at night coming down a ridge, the Gadigal Spur. They walked into an L-shaped ambush, and just every guy in the lead squad got hit immediately. And they repulsed the attack, but their point man, Josh Brennan, who was walking point, got hit 8 times, and the enemy was carrying him off alive at night down the hill. And Sal ran forward into machine gun fire, getting hit. But he caught up to them, and he killed the guys who were trying to take away his friend. And he pulled Josh back to safety and tried to tend to his wounds. And tragically, Josh died on the medevac leaving. But Sal saved the family an enormous amount of heartache and anguish, and probably saved the battalion a very dangerous operation trying to recover Josh, not knowing if he was alive or not, and more guys could have died, helicopters could have gone down. I mean, Sal really saved an enormous amount of suffering and heartache out there, and so he was awarded the Medal of Honor.
And there was another kid, Restrepo, who your movie is named after, that I think you had an encounter with his mom, and tell us how that, his story and how that movie came about.
When I decided to do this project, you know, I wanted to follow a platoon for a whole deployment, or as much of it as I could. And I thought, if I'm going to spend that much time with a platoon, I might as well shoot a lot of video. I didn't know much about it, but it didn't seem that hard to do. And I fortunately partnered with Tim Hetherington, who's a still photographer, and he had a video, you know, he had a video camera too, and so he loved the idea of a documentary, and so we did it together. Juan Sebastian Restrepo was the platoon medic. He was from Florida. He was an immigrant from Colombia. And he was killed in late July of 2007, and about a month later, the platoon built an outpost on this ridge to protect the main base, a 15-man, 20-man outpost. Very, very rough place, and got attacked a lot, and they named it Restrepo in honor of their medic, who they loved, and they were really grieved his loss very deeply.
So, in Afghanistan, you've seen this at closer firsthand than almost anybody else, or except for the soldiers who are there all the time, but the reporting that you're providing is conveying a sense, at least to me, that we shouldn't be putting kids in harm's way if there's no end in sight. The British have been turned back in Afghanistan. The Russians were knocked out of there. Americans don't seem to be doing all that much better. Really, is there a point, a long-term point for being there, or is there a chance of winning?
I mean, it's like the war on crime. You're never going to win the war on crime. The question is society better off fighting it or not fighting it? You know, if you live in New York City like I do, it's pretty clear that you need a police force. And so what would happen in Afghanistan if NATO pulled out? It would probably go back to the chaos and bloodshed of the 1990s. So first and maybe foremost, the Afghan people would pay a terrible price if NATO pulled out. That's a very different dynamic from when the Russians invaded. I don't know that much about the Brits, but, you know, the Russians invaded. They really invaded, and they were fighting all elements of Afghan society, the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, the Turkmens, the Pashtuns, of course. NATO was fighting the Pashtuns, and not even all the Pashtuns. And the rest of Afghan society, they're not thrilled to have foreign troops in their presence, but they're accepting of it because they know that the alternative is a far greater violence and misery for their country. So it really isn't it really is not an analogous situation to what the Russians were doing. The other question is it keeping us safer? I don't know. I mean, the fact is the U.S. has not been attacked since Al-Qaeda was displaced from Afghanistan into the tribal territories of Pakistan.
I see from the Sebastian Junger community online, there's a lot of soldiers are rallying around the message you've conveyed. That must be a pretty heartening feeling.
Yeah, it is. Very much so. I mean, I'm a journalist, and I try to be politically completely neutral about things. And I think the soldiers really appreciated that. You know, I mean, a lot of journalists go in, and I understand why. War is a terrible thing, and it's very political, and it's very, very tempting to sort of try to come up with some analysis, some sweeping sort of decision or understanding about where this is all headed or whatever. And it's very tempting to do that, but I really tried not to, and the soldiers really appreciated it. It was completely focused on their experience. And I made really good friends out there, and the fact that they liked my book, they feel it represents their experience accurately, to me is like an incredibly gratifying thing.
Okay, well, thanks very much for joining us. Listeners, look out for War. Thanks for joining us, Sebastian.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Breakout bestseller The Perfect Storm, Sebastian Junger created, as the LA Times Book Review described, a wild ride that brilliantly captures the awesome power of the raging sea and the often futile attempts of humans to withstand it. Now, Junger turns his brilliant and empathetic eye to the reality of combat, the fear, the honor, and the trust among men in an extreme situation whose survival depends on their absolute commitment to one another. His on-the-ground account follows a single platoon through a 15-month tour of duty in a dangerous and remote valley outpost in Afghanistan. Through the experiences of young men at war, Junger shows what it means to fight, to serve, and to face down mortal danger on a daily basis. This is a truly unusual book, perhaps one of the best accounts of warfare you'll ever read. Junger gives us a look inside the lives of frontline troops with none of the politics of the larger military operation. Here is Sebastian Junger reading his own work.
One valley to the north, two platoons from Chosen Company accumulated a casualty rate of around 80% during their deployment. Battle Company wasn't hit that hard, but they were hit hard enough. This morning I'm going to interview Justin Kalenitz, one of the wounded from Chosen, and O'Byrne has asked if he could join me. It's a cold, sunny day with little traffic and a north wind that rocks the car along the open stretches and on the bridges. We barrel southward through the industrial dross of New Jersey and Pennsylvania, talking about the deployment and the platoon and how strange it is, in some ways for both of us, to find ourselves in the United States for good. I spent the year visiting O'Byrne's platoon in the Korangal, but now that's over and neither of us will ever see it again. We're both dreaming about it at night, though. Weird, illogical combat sequences that don't always end badly, but are soaked in dread. Kalenitz was shot in the pelvis during what has come to be known as the Bella ambush. Bella was one of the firebases operated by Chosen Company in the Wagal Valley.
In early November, 14 chosen soldiers, 12 Afghan soldiers, a Marine, and an Afghan interpreter walked to the nearby village of Aranis, met with elders, and then started to walk back. It was a setup. The enemy had built sandbag positions in a 360-degree circle around a portion of the trail where there was no cover, and the only escape was to jump off a cliff. By some miracle, Chosen held them off. 6 Americans and 8 Afghans were killed, and everyone else was wounded. An American patrol hasn't taken 100% casualties in a firefight since Vietnam. We turn into Walter Reed Army Medical Center and park in front of Abrams Hall, where Kalenitz lives. We find him in his room smoking and watching television in the dark. His blinds are down and cigarette smoke swirls in the slats of light that come through. I ask Kalenitz when was the first moment he realized he was in an ambush, and he says it was when the helmet was shot off his head. Almost immediately, he was hit 3 times in the chest, 2 in the back, and then watched his best friend take a round through the forehead that emptied out the back of his head. Kalenitz says that when he saw that, he just went into awe. There were so many muzzle flashes around them that the hills looked like they were strung with Christmas lights. The rounds that hit Kalenitz were stopped by ballistic plates in his vest, but one finally hit him in the left buttock. It shattered his pelvis and tore up his intestines and exited through his thigh. Kalenitz was sure it had severed an artery, and he gave himself 3 minutes to live. He spotted an enemy machine gun team moving into position on a nearby hill and shot at them. He saw the men fall. He went through all of his ammunition except for one magazine that he saved for when the enemy came through on foot to finish everyone off. Kalenitz started to fade out from lack of blood, and he handed his weapon to another man and sat down. He watched a friend named Albert get shot in the knee and start sliding down the cliff. Kalenitz's team leader grabbed him and tried to pull him back, but they were taking so much fire that it was going to get them both killed. Albert yelled to his team leader to let go, and he did. And Albert slid partway down the cliff, losing his weapon and helmet on the way. He finally came to a stop and then got shot 3 more times where he lay. Rocket-propelled grenades were exploding all around them and throwing up so much dust that the weapons were jamming. Men were spitting into the breaches of their guns, trying to clear them. For the next hour, Kalenitz faded in and out of consciousness, and the firefight continued as one endless, deafening blur. It finally got dark, and the medevac bird arrived and started hoisting up the wounded and the dead. There was a dead man in a tree below the trail and dead men at the bottom of the cliff. One body fell out of the Skedco harness as it was being hoisted into the helicopter, and a quick reaction force that had flown in from battle company had to search for him most of the night. The last thing Kalenitz remembered was getting stuck with needles by doctors at the base in Assadabad. The next thing he knew, he was in Germany. His mother had come home to a message telling her to get in contact with the military immediately. And when she did, she was told that she'd better fly to Germany as fast as possible if she wanted to see her son alive. He was still alive when she arrived, and he eventually recovered enough to return to the United States.
Readers, lest old acquaintance be forgot, don't you forget to tune in next week for the first book report of 2011. Can you believe that date? We'll have many new segments for you and some exciting developments for readers and writers alike. How's that for dramatic foreshadowing? Thanks again to Erin James for the great theme music from her Soul Garden album. Erin, you rock, girl. This is Elaine Charles, and I hope you've enjoyed our look back. And now, looking ahead, I'm wishing you and yours a very safe and happy New Year's. See you next week. That's next year on The Book Report.
I've got this foolish pride, been messing with my mind, and it's a fine line.